Welcome to Just Us and the Climate, a podcast by the Climate Justice Coalition, where we bring climate change back down to earth and show how it's not only a crisis, but an opportunity to build a better and more just world.
Good day and welcome to another episode of Just Us and the Climate. It's your host for today, Alex Lanferner, the Secretary General of the Climate Justice Coalition. And on this exciting episode, where we're going to be talking about owning the renewable means of production and social ownership of renewable energy. And very excited to be joined by Professor Janet Cherry, who is an activist scholar, who is a professor in the Department of Development Studies at Nelson Mandela University. And excitingly, for the purposes of this particular podcast, just led a team that developed a report for the Presidential Climate Commission on social ownership of renewable energy. And so this is a really exciting and important report that is trying to put the ownership and the social ownership of renewable energy on the map so that we can transform who owns and who benefits from renewable energy. So welcome, Janet. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Alex. I'm excited to be here.
So, Janet, thank you so much for joining us here. I thought by way of introductions that it would be great to hear a little bit more about your background because, you know, in addition to being scholar and a professor at Nelson Mandela University, you also have this, you know, activist history for several decades, including, you know, robust anti-apartheid activism. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that history, but also what led you to this point where you're focusing on social ownership of renewable energy and why you see that as being important.
Well, maybe I could start by going back to my involvement in South Africa in the 1980s and being involved with the United Democratic Front, which was a very broad-based movement bringing together a front of many hundreds of different organizations to mobilize against a particular policy of the apartheid government, which it did very successfully. And what happened was that after 2000, when I was working in the academic space in the Department of Development Studies, I got drawn into doing some work with international NGOs, which were doing training in what we call strategic nonviolence. And I was invited by an Australian climate activist in a movement called Transition 10, where they were looking at the decade as being the decade which was absolutely critical for making this transition away from fossil fuels if we were going to survive as a society. And they were looking at how to put pressure on the Australian government to adopt different climate policies, different energy policies. And it actually, I can't say that particular campaign succeeded in their objectives. But if you look now at what's happened in Australia, there has been an absolutely fundamental move away from coal and towards renewable energy, PV solar in particular. So they asked me to share our experiences in South Africa, what we'd learned from mobilizing in the United Democratic Front, but also mobilizing the treatment action campaign against the South African government's policy around HIV and AIDS and the non-delivery by the public health services of antiretroviral medication. And the treatment action campaign is widely acknowledged as one of the most significant social movements worldwide to have affected government policy in a very fundamental way. So the Australian climate movement was looking at what they could learn from South Africa. So I learned from them in turn, and I became quite committed to the cause and the urgency of the just transition from fossil fuels. So what we did in Nelson Mandela Bay was to set up a Nelson Mandela Bay Transition Network, which was really initially with environmental activists who were lobbying for a vision for a different form of industry and economy in Nelson Mandela Bay. And we made recommendations to the council. We went to the COP17 meeting, which was held in Durban in end of 2011, and engaged in various forms of lobbying. But what then happened was that I became involved in what we call action research projects, which are trying to pilot new ways of doing things, which are in line with the transition from fossil fuel, but also in line with sustainable development of communities. And in the South African context, this means poor working class communities, informal settlements, townships in Nelson Mandela Bay. We started doing that firstly with the sustainable settlement pilot project in informal settlements, looking at different methods of construction of houses and different methods of provision of services, including water and electricity to those residents. And then the second project, which I'm still involved with now, was called Transition Township, to localize, essentially, to localize production of energy and also production of consumer goods, food sovereignty for local communities, and promote the idea of what is sometimes called a local living economy. And that local living economy can be very productive and very socially and developmentally appropriate. And not only for, you know, wealthy northern industrial cities, but for cities in countries all over the world, including South Africa. So we started thinking about how we could do this at a small scale and look at renewable energy, PV solar in particular, which is very, very appropriate for what they call a distributed energy system. Mm. And it can be decentralized, it can be localized, it can be owned by hundreds of thousands of people and who can cooperate in terms of forming cooperatives, using and selling energy, or having communal storage systems, or setting up communal facilities which are powered by solar energy, which they can then use to access whatever, electricity for charging devices, for doing education work, a whole range of applications which are very, very technically easy to implement and to manage by any community anywhere in the world. Mm. So this is a clear advantage of PV solar, and we thought we would test this in a formal township. So we're not talking about off-grid informal settlements. We're talking about a township where people have formal housing, which they usually own. They have a community which exists, i.e. they've been living with their neighbors for many decades in most cases. They have electricity, they have water, sewerage, etc. So the idea was to implement a PV solar cooperative that the residents of a particular local area of a township owned, and that they could then link that solar array to the grid and sell that electricity to the municipality. The idea would be that we would pilot this, and then we would model how this could contribute to not only to people's income by selling electricity as the cooperative members, but also contribute to solving the energy crisis by providing electricity, which is, firstly, it's renewable, and secondly, it could be produced and sold at a rate which could even undercut Eskom, and the municipality would only benefit from that. Mm. So the idea is the municipality is not losing customers, which is one of their fears, because the electricity is not being produced off-grid for private use, but is being sent into the grid and then is either being used by the municipality or wheeled to a third party, which is purchasing it. So the municipality is still selling the electricity as it is currently doing, but it's just receiving it from different sources. And the big difference, of course, is that it's not just receiving it from businesses, i.e. the businesses that can afford to put up solar arrays on their businesses. It's receiving it from ordinary residents, and they are benefiting economically. So we call that socialized ownership of the means of energy production. It's socialized because they are working cooperatively, whereas one township resident wouldn't be able to afford to put up a solar array with anything like enough capacity to make it meaningful to sell to the grid. You know, 50 township residents can do that. And 100 and 1,000 and 10,000 and 100,000 can make a very significant contribution to the energy needs in South Africa, well, in the city at least, and can also earn some significant income from that.
Thanks, Janet. Yeah, that's, I think, a really important example of, you know, a concrete project that's trying to deliver on social ownership of renewable energy. And maybe this brings us to, you know, maybe one of the definitional questions, because we're talking about social ownership of renewable energy, but what does that term mean? And maybe in your report, how did you guys go about talking about what that meant? Because I think there are different understandings of social ownership, some more narrow, some maybe a bit broad. So maybe what does it mean and why is it important? You know?
It's really critical because in South Africa, the debate is polarized. It's between central state ownership and privatization.
Yeah.
And people don't see that there's anything in between the two. So what we did is we looked at examples around the world of social ownership of renewable energy. And we found cases of, let me give you some examples, in Germany and in Southern Europe, other Southern European countries, there are cooperatives of residents of blocks of flats where they own the solar panels or solar arrays on the top of those blocks of flats as a cooperative. And each block of flats, let's say there are 1,000 people in that block of flats, they're a primary co-op. They are linked with all the other blocks of flats in that town, and that's a secondary co-op. Then they would link with the tertiary co-op, which actually covers more than 1 million members.
Okay.
So it's a cooperative way of producing energy, which benefits everybody who's part of that. It can include millions of people. You don't have to own a big solar plant. You just have to be a resident of a block of flats. So one is a simple example. Another example we got was of worker ownership of a solar array on a motor factory, a Volkswagen factory, in fact. And the workers who are workers in that factory, members of a trade union, they are then the owners of the PV solar array, and they then sell that electricity to Volkswagen for the production of motor vehicles. So they are the owners of the means of energy production. Straightforward. There are also examples in India of villages where the residents of the village are the owners and managers of a mini grid, which provides all the electricity needs of that village. So in that case, they are not putting it into a national grid, but they are meeting their needs through a mini grid, which is owned and managed by the residents of the village. So we looked at two broad models here. We looked at what we call a social-private partnership, and we looked at what we call a social-public partnership. So we said a social-private partnership would be, let's take, for example, the renewable energy independent power producer procurement program in South Africa. So this is typically where a commercial farm is approached by a big company which produces energy through wind turbines. These are usually big international companies. They then enter into an agreement with the farmer that they will put up the wind turbines on that farm, and they then produce and sell electricity to the South African government or to Eskom. They benefit. They make huge profits, by the way, these companies. And the farmer also has generally a very good deal from leasing his land and from the benefits of selling that, I mean renting that land for the use of the wind turbine company. So we said, well, why should not people who are owners of communal land benefit, or owners of land through land restitution program? or land redistribution program. Many, many rural communities in South Africa are living on communal land. Mm. So that would be an example where there's a partnership between the residents of that communally owned land and the private company which is providing the renewable energy. Public social partnership would be, for example, where a municipality partners with an informal settlement to implement a mini-grid.
Right.
And that could typically be in an area where it's not easy to implement, to extend the grid to provide normal electricity to that informal settlement.
Mm.
And the idea would be, and one has to be a bit careful in this because we looked at different examples where this has been tried, is that the renewable energy for an informal settlement or a rural village should not be seen as inferior or provide an inferior power supply.
Right.
So we would have to look at ways in which the municipality supplements the PV solar with other forms of energy like gas if necessary and so on, and or wind storage facilities which allow for adequate energy supply. But we do understand that there would need to be a subsidy, there would need to be government support in some way for these models to be implemented effectively. I.e., you can't expect the residents of a rural village to suddenly have the capital to put up a solar array or a wind farm. This is not how things are in South Africa.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to one of the central challenges of social ownership of renewable energy in South Africa, is that when we look at who is able to invest in renewable energy, particularly as the energy market becomes liberalized in South Africa, it is the more affluent, it's the bigger companies who have, you know, a lot of excess capital that they can invest. And they get a lot of benefits from it. They get cheaper energy, it's cleaner, it's maybe more reliable than Eskom's, or they can shelter themselves from Eskom. But for, you know, the majority of South Africans, there is a financial obstacle. The upfront costs are significant for renewable energy. So I believe in your report, you spoke a little bit about some of the financing needs that would be central to unlocking more socially owned renewable energy. I don't know if you want to speak to some of the proposals around that or some of the challenges that were discussed in that regard.
Well, the first point to be made is that the cost of renewable energy has been declining or decreasing rapidly over the last decade.
Yeah.
So if you do an analysis, if you're a municipality and you're planning to provide electricity to a new housing development, for example, or a new settlement, you would find that the cost, the capital cost of establishing a decent renewable energy supply is actually lower and it's quicker than providing a grid-based Eskom energy supply, depending, of course, on where the township is situated or where the village is situated, how much grid access there is already, etc.
Yeah, so maybe to transition from that then, what we're seeing is that the costs of renewables have declined significantly, and so now it is cheaper than alternatives. And so the question is, you know, how do we ensure that, you know, we're sharing the ownership benefits? And I think this is where there's this example when we talk about informal settlements, there's this Alexandra example that just happened where they invested in a microgrid for informal settlements there. But the ownership model, I think, is it's a partnership between city power and the provincial government. And so I think there isn't the same sense of ownership for communities that is driving a lot of the work in the particular reports that you're talking about and the recommendations within that. So maybe you could speak a little bit to, like, what is the state of social ownership of renewable energy in South Africa? Are we moving forward with it? Are we stuck behind a lot of other countries from your sort of comparative analysis that you did in the report?
We're way behind. Mm. I mean, there's a huge potential which has just not been realized yet. Yeah. And there are very small examples which are done as pilot projects and experiments. But in fact, even the examples of mini grids, for example, that you're talking about, are not owned by the residents of that area. They are initiatives of government. Mm. And it's a good thing. I mean, I'm not disputing that there's a need for it and for municipalities to be involved with energy provision. Mm. And it's actually a responsibility. So municipalities in areas where people are off-grid or informal settlements have an obligation to extend electricity in some way in terms of the free basic services policies. Right. So how they do that is, of course, important. But what our argument is that there's an economic benefit to residents from being producers of renewable energy. And as you say, I mean, we've seen a situation in the last 2 years since the electricity regulations were liberalized of not only businesses taking advantage of it, but middle-class households who can put up a few solar panels and who are completely free of load shedding and who can who can benefit marginally economically by feeding any surplus they have into the grid and then having a net metering agreement with the municipality where basically their municipal bill is reduced. But we think that it should be possible for working class households, for poor households, to not be just consumers dependent on government, waiting for their free allocation, struggling to get a few rand so that they can go and buy an electricity token, always struggling to have enough electricity, illegal connections because people are desperate to access electricity in their shack settlement. You know, those kinds of situations could actually just be completely turned around where people are producing more electricity than they need and can even sell it. Right. And why shouldn't they sell it? They can sell it if it is socialized.
Yeah.
So if they were supported, if every RDP house that was built had solar panels on it and they were connected to the grid and the, or they had a battery storage where they could have like a communal battery storage for a block of houses, they would have more than enough electricity than they needed.
Right. Yeah, thanks for that. And it's good to get a sense of the scale because I think it is still at the scale of like small projects across South Africa. And I think when I speak to some people, they worry that that social ownership will be piloted at the small scale as a way of almost making the liberalization a little bit more palatable because they can point to like, oh, look, there's a little social ownership project. And so liberalization has enabled that. So I wonder how we deal with the worry that social ownership might be a little tokenistic in how the government's dealing with it. And how do we move from this point of this like really, you know, small scale projects to social ownership being a driving force within the economy and, you know, being one of the major things that's happening in terms of the energy transition? I don't know if your report had particular recommendations on how we begin to move to that point where social ownership isn't just tokenistic and small while privatization, liberalization is running wild at a mass scale. But yeah, I think it's a real worry that people think about when it comes to the current transition in South Africa.
So there are two recommendations that we made in this regard. The one is in relation to the worker ownership model, as we call it. And we thought, you know, there are trade union investment arms or pension funds which have substantial capital. And that could be channeled into, you know, the purchase of solar arrays on the model that we're suggesting. Which would really be a game changer in terms of union members participating in the ownership of renewable energy means of production. The other example that we put forward, which we think requires some piloting, is for the social ownership to be linked to the REAP, the Renewable Energy IPP procurement program, through land distribution.
Okay.
And that would involve, you know, there's quite a big debate and demand in South Africa for land redistribution.
Right.
And we're saying if people who own land as beneficiaries of land distribution programs are then have access to not only rental of that land for renewable energy companies, but also share ownership of those companies. And that reprogram then has the potential to be a significant contributor to the economy.
Right.
And that is way beyond a pilot project, and it's way beyond what the REAP programs are doing at the moment.
Yeah.
So the REAP programs are allowing for a percentage of benefit to local communities, but it actually usually takes the form of some kind of education program or bursary program, something like that. But real economic benefit is yet to be seen.
Yeah. And maybe just by way of clarification, the REAP is the Renewable Energy Independent Power Procurement Program for those not familiar with all the acronyms. And I think there's been the critiques of this program because it has been driven largely like by bigger corporations, often, of maybe European background, or, you know, there was a critique that a lot of the projects had the same BEE partner, so that the benefits were concentrated in the hands of the few. And I think it's not an inherent thing of an independent power producer being necessarily a big corporate who's extracting profits. I think what you're pointing to is the possibility that independent can be socially owned, independent can be very different if we push that. Within your report, it seems that you're trying to suggest reforms of the REAP program. Do you know if there's any, what the IPP offices, the Independent Power Procurement Office, has any plans on that front? Or is this maybe something where there's going to be the need to push to ensure the reform of the REAP program?
I think the REAP program is going to be reformed anyway.
Yeah.
It's going to be restructured as the whole energy infrastructure in South Africa is restructured.
Yeah.
So as they put into place the new system for procurement and I can't remember what it's called, but the whole system is going to change basically.
Right. So it's the unbundling that's happening.
So that process is going to result in a different kind of REAP program.
Okay.
And I think what we're trying to say is that we can build into that new program something which is more strongly biased towards social ownership,
right,
or social than social benefit. Right. So social benefit is a very limited thing.
Right.
But if that social ownership is based on some percentage of share ownership, communal land ownership, and actual assets which can be used to generate income for rural communities especially, it would be important.
Right.
And then the other model around informal settlements and rural communities is also particularly important in terms of if you look at a typical rural village, where the provision of energy, electricity through renewable energy, wind and solar, can actually provide a stimulus for local economic development and provide greater benefits economically than simply households which have access to electricity, but can be a stimulus for all kinds of economic activity.
Right. Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of potential there. And I think one of the players in this, of course, is Eskom, and thinking about what their role could be in facilitating social ownership. And I think in some spheres, there's a worry that if we're focusing on social ownership and municipal ownership, that it might undercut Eskom and it might mean that they have less energy generation. But I think there's a role that Eskom could play in facilitating and driving socially owned renewable energy. And I think for us as the Climate Justice Coalition, we have our Green New Eskom campaign, which is very much about Eskom being a driving player. And for example, you know, if Eskom repurposed the hundreds of millions of rands that it spends on diesel every month and had invested that instead in socially owned renewable energies with communities, it would have been a very different picture we're looking at if they'd started doing that many years ago. So I'm wondering if your report touches on Eskom's role and maybe the some of the possible tensions that might exist there and how Eskom might be a player within this space. Yeah.
So I think the critical thing about Eskom is its role in distribution and the importance of the grid being strengthened and equipped to deal with the transition.
Right.
So, you know, the problem that we have is the centralization of the whole electricity system in South Africa because of it's based on coal and, you know, coal is based in Mpumalanga. Mm. So what we're looking at is a decentralized system,
right.
Distributed energy, it's called in the by the technical people. But
right.
We like the term decentralized.
Mm.
And I think that's a positive thing.
Right.
But the point is that we do have a electricity grid in South Africa.
Right.
And it has to be adapted to allow for renewable energy, like multiple feed-in points to allow for households and local solar arrays to feed into to feed into that network.
Yeah.
So there's a very important role for Eskom in that regard.
Right.
I don't want to go into the tariff policy now. Mm. I mean, there's a whole debate around NERSA and the setting of tariffs and whether they should be subsidized and so on. But we think from our modeling of the township model, which is the Saltuba cooperative model, where township residents are cooperative owners of a solar array feeding into the grid, that it would be possible to have a feed-in tariff, which would benefit the both the residents and the municipality. So then the municipality is buying electricity from the residents instead of from Eskom.
Okay.
But I've got to say, Eskom has a shortage of electricity to sell. Mm. So I can't see that as being a problem. And Eskom should be continue to generate electricity from nuclear or coal, whatever it's doing at the moment, which it is doing. And not be threatened by the fact that other people are producing electricity.
Mm.
I mean, in fact, I can't see how that how that is a threat to Eskom. It's actually assisting in solving Eskom's problem.
Mm. Yeah, and I think this is an interesting one because it does speak to maybe there's a tension within different views of what social ownership looks like. Because I think there is some who see social ownership as being a more centralized, a more Eskom-driven thing where Eskom is the one who's investing in renewables and is primarily driving it. And then there's others that have that much more decentralized vision where it's about empowering communities, empowering folks across the country to be, you know, the ones contributing to the energy and owning it. And I think, you know, in some ways there's a question of degrees, like how much is Eskom driving it and how much is it decentralized? And so it may not always be a hard, like, this camp, that camp, but there is a question of how do we balance the more centralized public ownership of renewable energy through Eskom versus the more decentralized community-driven. And I guess there's trade-offs along the way as you think about what that balance looks like. So I'm wondering how we negotiate that balance. I think that's something that I've often thought about because within the coalition we're trying to, you know, balance across different members who sit on different elements of that spectrum. So maybe that's more of a comment, but I don't know if you have thoughts on that based on the research that you guys have done.
No, it's an important question. So we did make a distinction between public, which is state at different levels, and social.
Yeah.
So we don't consider them to be the same thing.
Right.
So social ownership is not state ownership.
Right.
And it's very interesting because it reflects back on a long-standing debate within the labor movement, which is a strong anti-privatization move, which says anything that touches the central state and state ownership is a neoliberal policy based on privatization and is only going to benefit big capital and so on. And we are trying to argue that that's not the case.
Okay.
That in fact, the central state is not always the best way to in which to manage resources. And there are ways in which social ownership, which is decentralized, but it can take many different forms. I mean, it can be through labor, through residence, through rural villages. It's not bound to specific interest group. That social ownership is quite a viable alternative to the state, but it's not against the state. So it can be it's not competing with the state, and it can take the form of what we call a social public partnership. So let's say municipalities. I mean, we see municipalities as absolutely critical. That local government has a really important role to play. Its mandate is service delivery. And it should be working in partnership with social representation of the residents of those municipality in partnership, not in opposition. Idea that there's this antagonism between business and municipalities or people and the state and so on, is we have to get around that and look at ways in which those partnerships can be built.
Right. And I think this speaks to, can we design social ownership so it's symbiotic with public ownership and ESCOM, right, rather than parasitic. And I think this is really important because we have, some folks that want to lobby so that, if you're a renewable energy producer, you get to sell back into the grid and you get to profit off selling off the grid, but maybe you aren't contributing to the cost of upkeeping the grid. And so there's the question of, maybe big corporations that want to be able to use the grid to profiteer by selling like lots of renewable energy and wheeling it across the grid, but maybe aren't necessarily contributing to the fact that the grid itself is like a publicly owned good that needs to be, subsidized in its own way. And so I think this is where, when we design social ownership of renewable energy, we want to ensure that it's symbiotic so that it's contributing in a way that's positive to the public good, right? Rather than, I think what we see within perhaps some of the more profit-oriented renewable energy space, where there's an attempt to try to see if we can eke as much profit out without thinking about what the public good of the grid and of energy access is. So I think social ownership of renewable energy could be a way that we hopefully find that more symbiotic relationship, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
I'm curious about this term parasitic. So let's look at the municipal grid. So people who use the municipal grid are paying for electricity, and they're paying a service fee or a wheeling fee or a charge for the distribution of that electricity through the municipal grid. And we as ratepayers, we pay our rates and we contribute to the upkeep of all the infrastructure in the city. So I'm not sure where it becomes parasitic. I mean, one could look at, the communities who receive assistance to the poor, as it's called here. So they get a free basic services. That is an obligation of government at all levels, including municipalities, to provide that to people who can't afford and they don't pay rates then. But the people like me, who lives in a big house with a solar array, I pay quite substantial rates to the municipality. Businesses are taxed in various ways and contribute to the public purse in that way. I'm not sure if that needs to be adjusted in some way to, in terms of the energy system. But I do think this whole reconfiguration with the unbundling of ESCOM, et cetera, is going to have to grapple with that in some way.
And I think maybe that's what I'm pointing to maybe try and clarify, is that there's a worry as we unbundle and as the, there's this competitive market that, let's say, there's big private players that sell electricity into the grid and maybe get significant profits through doing so. but maybe they aren't contributing as much to the upkeep of the grid. So how do we ensure, you know, that the costs of the grid are properly shared and socialized? But maybe that's a bigger question for another time, is thinking about the grid as a public good. And how do we, as we promote socially owned renewable energy, ensure that we're also taking care of the socially owned good of the grid, right? But that might be podcast number two that we chat on that one.
Yeah. No, I mean, the other aspect of this, which we've emphasized in the report, is that local government has to be capacitated to deal with this transition.
Right.
They're really not able to do it at the moment. Around South Africa, municipalities are failing.
Right.
And they're failing in many regards, but much of the failure is management failure.
Right.
They're failing in terms of managing their finances, in terms of municipal expenditure,
right,
in terms of a whole, you know, infrastructure, maintenance, and so on. So the transition to renewable energy, the questions about feed-in tariffs, the smart grids, the implementation of new metering systems, new accounting systems, I mean, even the big municipalities, the metros, are struggling with it.
Right, right,
So how small municipalities are going to be able to deal with it, I don't know. But we really need, I mean, Selga has done quite some quite useful work on renewable energy and the just energy transition.
Right.
But it requires a massive program to capacitate municipalities to take this on board.
Right. Yeah, and I think this is where there is like the need to make major investments in these sorts of programs and investments in upgrading the grid and so on. And I think this is where there's a challenge, is hoping that that cost doesn't fall on ratepayers, but instead is progressively funded. And I think where for us as a coalition, we're thinking about proposals for wealth taxes and progressive taxation of polluters and so on as mechanisms to help fund that, so that we are, you know, investing in these sorts of programs not through regressive tariff increases, but through progressive taxation, right? And maybe that is part of how we enable social ownership, is through progressive taxation and pushing back against austerity, right? Because we do need to invest significantly in investing in the grid and in public renewable energy and so on. And so I don't know if within your report you talk about National Treasury having to contribute, and I wonder if you have thoughts on the current austerity measures and whether, you know, that there's a need to push back against them if National Treasury is going to contribute at the scale that's needed.
Well, it's a bit sort of ideological to say we must push back against Treasury.
Yeah.
I think we have to say Treasury needs to support positively the kind of initiatives that we're recommending in this report.
Okay.
And that means we are recommending strongly that there is a subsidy, a subsidized feed-in tariff, to encourage people to feed into the grid rather than going off-grid, which is actually what the danger that is being posed at the moment, is that businesses and those who can afford it just abandon the grid and abandon Eskom and say, well, too bad. We're just going to use our own resources.
Okay.
And that is the problem. So, we need to encourage Treasury to put into place measures which will encourage people to feed into the grid and be part of the system.
Okay. Yeah. And I guess my point was about how do we fund those sorts of measures. And so I think maybe there's some complementarity there. But maybe to transition to some broader questions. I mean, I think we've touched on various different elements of the report that you folks have been working on. But are there maybe things that you want to highlight, particularly key recommendations, and also some challenges that you see in terms of how those recommendations might become reality? So kind of a broad question about the report and, you know, what those recommendations look like and maybe some of the challenges going ahead.
So one of the recommendations we highlighted was the testing of the worker ownership model of renewable energy, and we thought it would be really useful to do that in the auto industry, because the auto industry is going to have to transition to electric vehicles. it's going to pose major restructuring challenges to that industry. And in this area where we're living here in Nelson Mandela Bay, which is based on the auto industry, people are feeling very threatened by it. Right. And we're looking at a way in which the labor unions, who are very threatened by the just energy transition, both in industry and in mining and in energy production in the coal-fired power stations, that they can be somehow brought in as beneficiaries, as owners of the just energy transition, rather than as a sort of people who are left out of the process and who need to be looked after as in some other way.
Right.
So our recommendation is, for example, that this model of putting up solar arrays on motor industry factories, which can provide electricity for the use of those industries and which are owned by labor unions, can be done as a way of bringing labor on board in the just energy transition, so that they are both investors and shareholders and economic beneficiaries of the energy transition. So that's one recommendation. We also looked at this in terms of decommissioned power stations and how they can be repurposed into productive assets which are owned by either labor unions or communities. And we looked at the Komati decommissioning as a sort of example of how, well, we won't go into it in detail here, but how things could be done differently. And what could be done in terms of bringing those communities and the workers of those power stations into a productive use. And we looked at an example here of the Swartkops power station, which was decommissioned in the late 1980s, I think.
Okay.
And the community around that power station could still be use that as an asset for cooperatively owned renewable energy production, agrivoltaics, and waste recycling centers, other forms of production. At the moment, it's being used for storage of manganese for export. So, yeah, it would be, I believe the manganese for export is going to be moved to the Kuche, the port of Nuche, the new harbor, the Kuche IDZ. And in that case, that that area, would, which is a residential area, could be repurposed to something completely different.
Okay. Yeah. It sounds like there's some, you know, coupling social ownership of renewable energy with a host of other economic activities is kind of key to building a more diversified economic vision in a lot of ways. And I think having visited the Kwazekele site that you folks have worked on as well, that it's not just about renewable energy installation. It's also about, you know, agroecology. It's about recycling centers. It's about rainwater harvesting. There's a host of different things that you're coupling together. And I guess this is where maybe socially owned renewable energy can be a bit of an anchor towards broader economic diversification, hopefully, right?
Yeah, economic diversification and also moving away from dependency on one one form of production. For example, in the Mpumalanga coal mining towns, you know, often the energy transition is portrayed as a threat.
Yeah.
Are we going to lose X thousand jobs in the coal mines and in the coal-fired power stations? What is going to happen to those people? But if you look at the environment in which people are living in those mining affected communities, as they call themselves, the potential is for them to have an alternative development program or policy, which is based on sustainable production, which is going to meet people's needs rather than producing coal, which is going to be sold and used for power stations around the world.
Right. Yeah. So maybe one of my last questions, and this goes back a little bit to to one of the recommendations you were talking about, which is the subsidized feed-in tariff that National Treasury would be implementing. And I'm wondering if the feed-in tariff would just be a universal one that all could apply to, or is there ways that a feed-in tariff could be tailored to promote particularly social ownership of renewable energy? I'm not sure if that's within the recommendations, or maybe that's getting a little too into the weeds and something that needs to be looked into.
So in the report, we didn't go into detail into the modeling of the feed-in tariff.
Okay.
But we gave an example of how it could work in a typical township,
okay,
as KwaZakhele being the example, and how we've modeled it there.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm not sure whether it would be possible to recommend a universal one. I think one might have to look at different types of municipality for a start.
Okay.
So the big metros, which have a lot of industry and so on, might have a different tariff to rural villages and so on. So,
Yeah, that helps. Yeah, I'm just thinking there's a worry that in the back of my mind where if we introduce a feed-in tariff, that those that could maybe benefit from it the most are those that already have access to a lot of capital and land to be able to invest in renewable energy, that it might, you know, help the more affluent. And so is there ways that we can structure it? And maybe this is where social ownership, you know, and the need to fund it is so important, so that it doesn't, it's not the case that a feed-in tariff just benefits those that already can afford to invest in renewable energy, right?
No, I agree. So, I mean, just the one thing is that I was listening to the webinar this morning of Chris Yelland on the lessons from Australia.
Yeah.
And Anton Eberhardt from UCT was giving an input there on the very extensive uptake of rooftop PV solar in Australia, and how they are surpassing their targets for transitioning away from fossil fuel. And you know, Australia was also very coal dependent, and they've been making an extremely rapid transition away from coal, which is significant.
Right.
And I'm thinking, you know, we have very similar energy resources in South Africa in terms of renewable energy as well, in terms of solar and wind. And we should be looking at how Australia has done this. And I just want to emphasize what our president said 2 years ago.
Right.
He said we are looking at the massive rollout of rooftop solar.
Okay.
So my challenge is to say, you know, since that liberalization of the energy regulations in South Africa, we've seen extensive uptake of rooftop solar.
Right.
But from the affluent section of the population. So how do we make that massive rollout of rooftop solar apply to every township household?
Yeah. And I think this is it. We just can't leave it up to the market. And I think this is the challenge. It's been left up to the market in a big way. And even the tax incentives that were put in place, who can benefit from the tax incentives? It's not your average working class family who maybe won't be paying necessarily those taxes, or even if they are, maybe can't afford to wait until the tax bill comes to get the credits back. And so it seems we've driven the mass rollout through market logic, not through the logic of justice, not through the logic of social ownership. So this is, I guess, what this report is trying to push back on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much, Janet. I think we've been having quite a rich discussion, and maybe I want to open it up for if there's anything else that you want to pull out from the report, or more broadly, is there anything that you want to close up with in terms of encouraging people to push for more social ownership, some calls to arms that you maybe want to bring to encourage people to get involved in this space?
Well, just to end with the point that, you know, South Africa is still the most unequal society in the world in terms of distribution of wealth and economic access.
Right.
So I think the point about the social ownership of renewable energy is we have to see it as an opportunity for economic redistribution.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to get this point across, because instead of people seeing it as a threat, to see it as an opportunity to transform the economy
yeah.
in a way which allows far greater benefit and participation of ordinary South Africans
right.
who are at the moment excluded from the economy.
Mm. Yeah, thanks, Jen. I think that's really great. Is that we are an economy that's based on the ownership of, you know, most of the wealth in the hands of the few. So is this an opportunity to really ensure that the renewable economy and the renewable means of production are owned by the many? And this is a transformative opportunity. So hopefully we can work together to ensure that happens and that we aren't stuck with the current reality, which is, you know, the renewable economy being dominated again by the affluent and the wealthy, right? Well, I think with that, we can bring this episode to a wrap. And thank you so much, Janet, for joining us and for all the work that you've done on socially owned renewable energy. I maybe should also mention, of course, that the Climate Justice Coalition was quite involved in organizing a stakeholder dialogue that helped to inform that report. And we certainly will be working hard to advance social ownership of renewable energy. So looking forward to hopefully continuing to work together on that front. Thank you, Janet.
Yeah, and the report is on the Presidential Climate Commission website.
Right.
So please read it and give your feedback.
Fantastic. And I'll also link it into the show notes for those that are accessing this online so that they can access it more directly.
Great.
Well, thank you very much, Janet. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for this episode of Just Us and the Climate. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Just Us and the Climate, a production of the Climate Justice Coalition. To find out more about the coalition and our work to advance climate justice, visit climatejusticecoalition.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and share it widely. The more people it reaches, the more we can help grow the movement for climate justice. This podcast is made possible thanks to the financial support of the Open Society Foundation.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.